Acts 17, we've been in both the Wednesday class and the Sunday class talking about a similar subject, the times of ignorance, as it's described in Acts chapter 17. Paul talked about the passing over of the sins done aforetime. I don't know, Betty, I don't see her, but she'd raised a question in the Wednesday night class as far as the Jews and how sin was dealt with and the Old Testament system for the Jewish people, the Hebrew people, and the high priest. One of the things that I guess came to my mind after that class was, when you think about the process that God had in place, he was passing over sins, Romans 3:25. A little more perhaps was required for the Jewish people, a high priest, the Day of Atonement each year, those blood sacrifices, because the Jews had received more and you might say were more accountable. As you look at Acts 17, we finished up with verses 30 and 31, two key verses. Again, 30, the times of ignorance, therefore God overlooked. Now he commands men that they should all everywhere repent. The reason for that is in verse 31, he has appointed a day in which he's going to judge the world. That judgment is going to be based on righteousness. It's going to be by the man, quote unquote, that he's ordained or selected. That's going to be Jesus Christ. And then he says, whereof he has given assurance unto how many people? All people, every person who has ever lived can be assured, living or dead, that they will one day stand before Jesus Christ. That is the point. Betty, I just made a comment about you. I think it was a positive comment, so I can follow up with you about class. But it was something that you said Wednesday night. It brought some additional information to mind. So remind me to see you after class if you want that information. Now we're ready for Acts chapter 17, verses 32 through 34. Now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, there were some who mocked, there were others who said, we will hear thee again concerning this. Thus Paul went out from among them, but certain men clave unto him and believed, among whom also was Dionysius the Areopagite, and a woman named Demarius, and others with them. Anytime you're dealing with people, and this is especially true for preachers or perhaps even a Bible class teacher, but preaching especially, if you present a sermon and you have at least, I'm going to say, a dozen people there, 50 or more, 100 or more, do you think you're going to get different reactions from that sermon? All right. You have 100 people, they all hear the same sermon. Some walk away and think what?
It was a really good one. And they got a lot
of help. I mean, this was really helpful to me. Maybe it was the best sermon the guy ever preached. That's sort of this end of the spectrum. But at the other end of the spectrum, what do you find?
It
could be boring in capital letters. I did not get a thing out of that. It was too long, and it was the worst sermon the guys ever preached. Well, hopefully most guys are somewhere in the middle. But you do find sometimes some extreme reactions. Sometimes a person says, well, it was way too long. Another time, a guy says, it was way too short. I looked at a fellow's preaching the other day on YouTube. He seems to average an hour. And I thought, wow, in today's world, that seems to be a long time. But anyway, that seems to work for him. You find some other differences. You can have someone who say he used too few passages, or another person will say he used too many. Anybody ever listen to a guy who used too many passages? I had a few hands. I had a teacher. I'm not sure that he really knew what all the passages meant, but he would cite a minimum of 100 passages, a famous preacher, 100 passages every time he preached. I mean, he'd just rattle them off. Zechariah 3, Haggai 2, Malachi 6, or there's not Malachi 6, but Malachi 1, and, you know, Zephaniah 3, 5, and I mean, he just bang, 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 and you would barely be able to write them down, and there was no PowerPoint. I mean, he just threw them all in there, and a lot of sermons had the same passages. So for some people, that was an impressive way to preach. Other people didn't appreciate it so much. But ultimately, when people are exposed to Bible teachings, we have only two reactions, ultimately, don't we? Only one of two outcomes. Outcome number one is you believe it and you, well, and obey it. Option number two is you don't accept it on some level, and you therefore are disobedient. Those are the only two choices. And that's what we see here in Acts chapter 17, verses 32 through 34. When Paul was at Jerusalem, the religious center of the world, he was mobbed. We're going to see that a little later in Acts chapter 21 and Acts chapter 22. Here, he's at Athens. He's dealing with these people who are so-called intellectuals. He's mobbed. He's later going to be at Rome. That would, of course, been the political center of the world, and there is martyred. 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 6. So three very different reactions to his preaching. Here, what was causing people to say it's nonsense? They were mocking. What was the subject that they heard? And they said, oh, no, there were some who said, oh, no, that can't be true. They're sneering, they're jesting, joking about it. All right, the idea of dead people coming back to life. Now, this word, which is translated mock, it is only used twice in the New Testament. The other time it's used is in Acts chapter 2. That's going to be Acts chapter 2 and verse 13. Remember, Peter, the apostle, stood up on the day of Pentecost, and the Bible says there were people who said, you are filled with new wine, and they mocked. They engaged in this sneering, this jesting. Well, Paul is experiencing that same kind of thing here. The Greeks, anybody know or remember how the Greeks viewed the human body, positively or negatively? Good or bad? If you guess, you got a 50% chance of being right.
Good.
Huh?
They thought they were good, right?
No, they thought they were bad. The body was something to be freed from. The body was something that was restrictive. Now, if that's your view that the body is bad, and somebody comes to town saying, one day there's going to be a resurrection of the... Yeah, and the body's going to be raised, then you're thinking, because of your mindset, that cannot be a good thing. You know, somebody says, as far as the later years, they look at people and they're perhaps old and decrepit and having some difficulties, and the person says, when I get to that age or that time of life, what don't I want? I don't want to be in that shape. I want to have good health, and I want to be strong. So that was kind of how the Greeks were looking at things. The faster a person could leave his or her body, the dead. So Paul's going there and contradicting that particular beliefs. However, we do have at least a few who were more open-minded. They said, we're willing to hear you when? Look at the end of verse 32. We will hear thee concerning this later, or yet again. There will be a second time where we're willing to listen. That happens a lot today. You're talking to someone, perhaps you're dealing with a car dealer, and you say, I'll come back. I want to think about it. Not today, but maybe later. And perhaps you do go back and buy the car, perhaps not. Here, as we look at Luke's account, he says there were some people who eventually did what? They joined him. ASV in the first part of verse 34 says they clave to him, and they believed. The word clave has been defined as become someone's disciple. So you have this man, the Areopagite, somebody who was a member of that council, we think, and also this woman named Demarius. And it wasn't a huge success, but at least there were some people who were willing to become Christians. Anything over these verses or anything over Acts 17 before we move into Acts 18? Brian?
I think it's interesting that here, as well as Acts chapter 22 or 24, when Paul's with Felix, he tells this story. I have nothing they already accused me of except for this one thing, touching the resurrection, and then Felix shuts it down. And then when Paul's with Agrippa and Festus later, he speaks until he gets to resurrection, then Festus says he's mad. So resurrection seems to be a problem for these people, idea of it.
Yeah. And Paul goes back, well, not only with the resurrection, you have the judgment there, and those seem to be big themes in Paul's life, his preaching, his teaching, and he wanted people to think about the fact that your life involves a lot more than your life here on earth. You will continue to live, you will stand before God, and are you ready? He just pounded that point time and time again. I think that's a good point to make with people today. They're doing their thing, and a question for us is, you're living your life. Maybe you like your life, maybe you don't. But one day, this life is going to be over. You will stand before God in judgment. Are you ready for that day? Do you want to be ready for that day? Do you know how to be ready for that day? And it's a practical message and an important message. So, great comment. Anybody else before we move into Acts 18? Betty. Well, I think when we look at where people are, and this is what you find in the book of Acts, they got an understanding of where, you see that next chapter 17, Paul, he sees the idolatry, and that's where he starts. We've got to in the case of idolaters, show that there is one God. So they believed in deities, they just hadn't figured out which one they needed to believe in. In this particular case, you're actually having to back up a little bit more and show, number one, why we would conclude that there is a God. Now, there are different ways to do that. There are different arguments that have been put forth. One argument, for example, would be the moral argument. If there is no power higher than man, where does morality derive from? Why can we say that murder and robbery are wrong? Now, we do have in our culture right now, there is a new movement which seems to be redefining morality. And if you are seeing some of the fringes of that, we all are, as far as where people, their thinking is. If you go back and you study the writings and the ideas of Karl Marx, the right and wrong is not so much the Christian morality we've seen, but it is a right and wrong in the sense of if you are of the working class, you know, can loot and steal, those kinds of things, because you're underprivileged. So I think that is maybe an opening for us as we start talking about right and wrong. Do you believe that these activities that we can sometimes see on TV are right or wrong? Well, no, why? Do you believe that murder is wrong? Well, no, it's not. Yes, I do believe it's wrong. No, it's not right. Well, why? So the moral argument, if there is no moral standard, I mean, we can do whatever we want. So that's a difficulty. Another argument, some people have said, well, this isn't a good argument, but it is, because the Bible uses this. In the book of Hebrews, I think it's about Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 4, the Hebrew writer said, every house is built by somebody. I mean, we would look at the computer or the book or the pews, we say this has a designer behind it. So there is an argument for design. If there is, it was, I think, back in the 1600s, kind of put into logical format by a fellow who came up with a watchmaker illustration. If you see a watch, there must be a watchmaker. If we have design, there must be a designer. And if there is a designer, then we start looking around for him. So there are at least half a dozen arguments. You can find several of them on the internet. I can help you get some more information about that if you like. But those basic arguments will point people back to some kind of deity. And then you can start looking around and saying, all right, if this deity does exist, or some deity does exist, it would make sense that possibly that deity or those deities have communicated with man. And what books are available that claim? And there are multiple books. You've got the Mormons, for example. They claim that they had an angel. And you've had Mary Baker Eddy. The Bible certainly is in that mix. And then you start looking at those books to determine if there are any contradictions or if they are reliable. Historical evidence for them and so forth. Jesus enters into the picture. You know, how does he fit? Did he really exist? That would be one question. If he did, then you would look at ways to determine if the information in the Bible, the historical records, especially Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are correct. Go back and look at the prophecies. So it's a series of building blocks there. And it does take some time, but a lot of people have used those building blocks and developed that faith in God, faith in Christ, faith in the Bible, and sometimes even turned out to be preachers. Okay. All right, let's pick up with Acts chapter 18 and verse 1. After these things, he, that's Paul, departed from Athens. Where does he go? Corinth. So if you've got your map, that color map, you can find Corinth on the map. This is probably about AD 52, so the church has been in existence for about 20 years. Luke does not explain Paul's departure. It might be that Paul thought his time in Athens had not been as productive as he wanted, so he's thinking, let's go to a different territory. It's also possible that Paul had received some divine guidance that moved him over to Corinth, but he does go, and he goes without anybody. He goes alone, and you can see, I think, some reasons that a little later why that may have been a little uncertain for him. In fact, let's just skip ahead a little bit in Acts chapter 18 and verse 10. We'll also pick up at verse 9. I'm going to add that as well. And the Lord said unto Paul in the night by a vision, be not what?
Afraid.
Now, I don't know about you, but when I think about Paul, the word fear really doesn't come to my mind. But Acts 18 and verse 9 tells us that he did have some significant concerns. God uses this vision to tell him, don't be scared, but speak, don't hold back, don't hold thy peace, I'm with thee, nobody's going to set on thee to harm thee, and I have, God says, much people in this city. When I think about there was an old preacher who talked about snails getting on the ark. Now, maybe the ark was close to a water source and they didn't have very far to go, but assuming that they did, that was probably a long trip for those snails. They had to be persistent. That was going to be true for Paul at this stage in his life. He was going to have to really push hard to make some things work. When you think about Athens and Corinth, if you look at the map, you can see that the two are not very far from each other. Distance-wise, they're only about 50 miles apart. But like today, I've not been to Washington, D.C., but I've been told that there are some nice sections and just a block or two over, what do you find? Anybody ever been to Washington? No? All right. If you're just a block or two over, can it change?
Yes.
And it's ghetto almost. I mean, it's really bad. It's dangerous. And it's interesting how it can be so nice over here, but you move over just a little bit more. And other cities have that same issue. We say, boy, this is a really nice area, but half a mile down the road, you're in an area where things are, you know, kind of scary. It's not good. Well, you have Corinth and Athens seemingly pretty close, only by 50 miles, but they are very, very different. If you're in Athens, as we've seen with the philosophers, it was a place of culture, it was a place of learning. Corinth, though, even though it's a Roman colony and was noted for its trade, it had wickedness. And I mean the sin in there. People talk about doing things in Las Vegas. Corinth probably would have made Vegas look like a very nice place. It also had a different take as far as a lot of philosophies, a lot of religion. I'm going to give you this quote. No city in the Roman Empire was more corrupt. This, that's Corinth, was filled with Greek adventurers, Roman merchants, lustful Phoenicians, sharp-eyed Jews, ex-soldiers, near philosophers, people trying to become philosophers, sailors, freedmen, slaves, tradesmen, and agents of every kind. It's interesting that Paul, as he is in Corinth, he writes the letter to the Romans. And anybody remember from Romans chapter 1, starting with about verse 18 and going down through about verse 32, what Paul says there? What's he talking about? Romans 1, 18 to 32. Anybody remember?
Wickedness of Gentiles.
Yeah. And he's going through, he just starts listing all kinds of sins. And we spent some time on Wednesday nights looking at all those sins. Maybe Paul's thinking as he's writing that list, I'm in the midst of that. I can actually see that stuff here at Corinth. And then let's flip over for just a second to a different book. Let's look at the Corinthian letter. Let's take a look for just a second at the first chapter, 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 21. There are some statements that we're going to refer to probably a few times in this class, maybe next week as well, to kind of see what was on Paul's mind as he's at Corinth. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 21. He says, "For seeing that in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom knew not God, it was God's good pleasure through the foolishness of preaching to save others." Maybe he's writing that as far as the foolishness of preaching. As he's writing that to the Corinthians, perhaps he's thinking back to what time in his life? The foolishness of preaching. People saw it as foolishness. Where did they see that? What chapter did we just leave? Acts 17. And who was he talking to? Well, he was talking to the Athenians, the people of Athens, and what did they do? They mocked, remember? They sneered, they joked. So as Paul's writing to the Corinthians later, maybe that was on his mind. Paul stays, as we look at Acts chapter 18 and verse 11, in this city for what seems to be an unusual amount of time. Anybody want to read Acts 18 and verse 11 for us? Okay, now that's a long time for Paul, but he was, you might say, a located preacher for this period of time. Corinth, Steve?
Well, there's a notation in my Bible that says about 121 in Corinthians, says, "Men are to be convinced not by the wisdom, by the preacher's wisdom, but the power of the Holy Spirit."
Okay, and that was certainly what Paul was...
So there are people that will follow after what men say, because they say it eloquently and such, but that's not what it's all about.
Correct.
Message is what's important.
Exactly right. Paul had some of that at Athens, and he's also being hit by some of those people, and it was a problem. We'll actually develop that a little bit more, so good comment in just a little bit. Corinth was a big city, estimates are kind of wide-ranging. Some would put the population as low as 20,000. Some others would go as high as 300,000. They also had some slaves. They've estimated that the number of slaves could have been as many as 460,000 people. This was, by first century standards, and even by our standards today, a very large place. In fact, when you look at Paul's life, there are two cities that really stand out. One was Corinth, and the other was Ephesus. Have letters to both of them, and they show up in the book of Acts as well. Corinth, you may be able to see this on your map. It was the capital of Achaia. And it was, when you look at all the great cities in Asia, it was in communication with all of them because of where it was located, because of its seaports. Julius Caesar had rebuilt it in AD 46. It was situated on a narrow strip of land. You can see that, I think, on your map. And you've got two large bodies of water there, so that gave them two seaports. Now, if you're in that strip of land and you've got a seaport on the east and you've got a seaport on the west, do you think that you're probably going to be a place of trade, that it's going to be an area that is very commercialized?
Sure.
I mean, it's just like prime spots today. People say, we want a prime spot for real estate because all the traffic. Some of us have probably heard the story, true or not, I don't know, but I think it's true, that Sam Walton, when he wanted to pick a location for a new Walmart store, he'd go up in an airplane, and in an area he would just be watching the traffic flow to see, all right, well, you know, not much is going on over here, but over here there's a lot of traffic and there's some open land, so that's going to be where I get my Walmart store. I remember several years ago, Teresa and I were mildly playing with the idea of, this was about 30 years ago, mildly playing with the idea, trying to figure out whether to get more education or maybe go down to Tennessee and buy a little convenience store. And the lady that we were talking to, as far as the realtor, she said, what I would suggest to you is that you go get a cooler, put something in it to eat and drink, and sit up on the hill and watch the traffic for a while. Just see the traffic flow into the store to see how many customers come in. And I thought over the years, that was, had we done that, and we didn't explore that too much, but had we done that, that would have been a good way, because you want to have a good flow of traffic. People understand that if that's what your business involves. Okay, a little bit more here. The Corinthians were the first in Greece to engage in modern ships and shipping. Corinth was regarded as Greece's wealthiest city, and it just boasted about its wealth. It was a place to make money. It was a place to spend money. If we could go back in time, we would find that Corinth had a navy, and at one time their navy rivaled what the Athenians had. And when you have that navy, when you've got all kinds of people coming in, obviously a lot of sailors, what do you think your community is going to be like? A lot of traffic from a lot of people, and a lot of those people are sailors. What do you think is going to happen?
Roughness.
It's going to be rough. I mean, it may not be completely a sailor's town. They were apparently known for a lot of sailor stories, but they were going to have some very bad things. Poseidon, anybody remember anything about that pagan god? Poseidon?
The god of the sea.
There you go. And Corinth was dedicated to that god. That, I think, gives you some indication as far as attachment to the sea. There were gladiatorial shows. Most are familiar that in the first century they had the arenas, and there were gladiators that went out there, sometimes fighting beasts, sometimes fighting men. They had very suggestive sayings. There was a Corinthian lady, or to Corinthianize. Those were descriptions of an immoral woman or immoral acts. You've got the wealthy ship captains coming in. In our country, thinking back to the 1800s, you've got the cattle drives. Cowboys out there, you've got the fella who was out there leading the herd. And when that herd finally got to Fort Worth or wherever the place was that the herd was being driven, you think those guys were paid well? Been out in the trail for a long time, and you bring the cattle in. Here are the goods. Here are the animals. Yeah, get a lot of money. Well, if you think about it from the terms of a cowboy, you can look at it as sailors as well. They come into port and they unload their cargo. They get paid. They're thinking, boy, we've got a lot of money now. What are we going to do with it? We're going to go spend it. And Corinth offered all kinds of things to do. Sexual sin was prevalent. It was rampant. They had a temple to Aphrodite, and in that temple they had 1,000 priestesses who were prostitutes. And if you wanted to worship, you went to the temple and found one or more women, and you paid. And the money that was paid to the temple prostitutes was regarded as sacred income. Now, if you've got a setup like that, how popular do you think that's going to be with these guys that have been out there on the ship for 6 months or a year? You're not going to have too many dull days, because you've got all kinds of people coming in. Once commentator said, the Corinthians were shown, when they were pictured, they were shown drunk, if ever featured on a Grecian stage. He also noted how Corinth was dominated by the hill of the Acropolis. I'm giving you a quote here. The hill was not only a fortress, it was a temple of Aphrodite. In its great days, the temple had 1,000 priestesses of Aphrodite who were sacred, prostitutes who came down at evening. They came down to the city streets to ply their trade. To become a proverb, not every man can afford a trip to Corinth. So as Paul is dealing with this culture, he surely knew a little bit about what it was like. It was like, wow, when I go there, it's going to be a big challenge. In fact, let's take a look at the Corinthian letter again. Let's go back. I said we're going to run a couple references there. Let's take a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 2. We'll read verses 1 through 5. Anybody want to turn over there and read that text for us, 1 Corinthians 2, 1 through 5? All right, Bonnie? Thank you very much. Let's go back and look at verse 3. Paul says, and I, remember, he's alone when he goes to Corinth. I was with you, and I was with you in what? He says, I was weak, and I was fearful. Once again, we find that, Acts chapter 18. Don't be fearful, Paul. He says, I was, and I was also trembling. And he says, not just trembling, he says, I was in much trembling. So when he goes to Corinth, I mean, this is the place where if somebody says, let's go plant a church there, the other guy might say, I don't think that's a real good idea. I mean, these people are rough. These people, they just love sin. I mean, this was, as I said, no place was immoral. So it has a reputation of not only being a sinful place, it is, we might say, above normal sin. Well, why go there? Whether Paul was directed here by the Holy Spirit or whether he chooses to go here on his own, why go here? What have we said about the city? People going and coming or not? All kinds of people going and coming. And some of the people are in ships. They're going to end up in, you know, places where who knows what. So if you go there, you can establish a church. You have an outreach program. You're starting to maybe pull in some of the priestesses and convert them, and some of the people on ships, they come to town long enough where you can teach them the gospel. All of a sudden, Corinth is going to be sort of a hub, and the truth is going to be going out from a lot of different places. Our brethren and other religious groups as well, when, for example, Russia opened up, do you want to go to that distant city in Russia, or you want to go to the capital city, Moscow, where people are coming and going all the time? Got a big airport there, and that's how people get in and out of the country. Where do you want to go? You want to go to the capital. So, again, it made sense because Paul was in a type of crossroads area when it came to Corinth. If the gospel could get a foothold here, it was going to work well in other places. Anybody want to say anything else before we look at Acts 18:2? All right, let's take a look at that. And he, that's Paul, found a certain Jew named Aquila, a man of Pontus by race, lately come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to depart from Rome. Paul, alone, fearful, comes to Corinth. He meets these two people, this couple. And we read about this couple six times in the New Testament. Now, before Paul enters into, let me change my word. Because Paul entered into secular work shortly after he comes to Corinth, we've got information in some later verses that can, I think, be tied back to this. Maybe not necessarily just this time, but certainly this time would be included. Let's take a look at 1 Corinthians 11 and a little bit later in the book of Acts, Acts 20 and verse 34. Who's willing to flip over to 1 Corinthians 4 and read verses 11 and 12? 1 Corinthians 4, 11 and 12. Brian, will you get that? Okay, 4, 11 and 12 from 1 Corinthians. And then two chapters later in Acts, let's take a look at Acts chapter 20 and verse 34. Anybody want to read that for us? Acts 20, verse 34. Gary. Okay, Brian, if you're ready, and stay in there. Corinthian letter, if you will. We'll turn you over to 2 Corinthians in a bit. 1 Corinthians 4, 11 and 12.
Even at this present hour, we both hunger and thirst and are naked and are buffeted and have no certain dwelling place and labor, working with our own hands, being reviled, we bless, being persecuted, we suffer.
Okay, Paul writing to the Corinthians, so it is at a later time, but he says, what are my circumstances like, good or bad? Easy or rough? They're hard. They're rough. They're difficult. They're not easy. He said, we're having to support ourselves. We're having to go out and work with our hands. And he said, he said, we're still struggling. We're hungry and don't have adequate clothing. Life is difficult. That second reference, Gary, Acts chapter 20 and verse 34.
Yea, ye yourselves know that these hands have ministered unto my necessities and to them that were with me.
Okay. Paul, once again, is reminding people, I think the context there is Ephesus, but he is telling people, I had some needs, not some wants. I had some needs, food, clothing, and shelter, and it was my hands that was working to supply that. Now, here is the picture that I want to set up for you, and then I want to provide the application. Here's Paul. He's over in Athens. Things have been kind of so-so there. So he makes this 50-mile trip over to Corinth. He knows that it's a rough place. How many people do you think he knows in Corinth?
Nobody.
No friends, no acquaintances. It looks like from the passages that we've had, how much money does he have?
Very little.
All right, very little. Not much to his name, almost penniless. Where's he going to go and stay?
Living on the streets.
Well, he don't know. He could be living on the streets. There's no house that he's going to. And what job does he have lined up when he gets there? He has a skill. He has that ability, but there's no job that he's going to. So here is a guy, he's kind of on the down and outs. No friends in the new city. It's a big place, corruption, very easy to be taken advantage of. Thugs there, all kinds of bad things. This guy doesn't have anything to his name and no resources. Can't pull out a credit card and try to charge things for a little bit. How does that scenario help people today? Are there Christians who are in that kind of situation today? Oh, okay. Yes, that's the answer, but let's back up a step. Are there Christians who say, I've lost my job, I'm almost penniless, I'm not quite sure about what's going to happen with my house. I'm losing my house. I'm being kicked out of my apartment. Do we find Christians in those circumstances today? Yes, we do. Well, then would it be appropriate to turn people back here to Acts 17/Acts chapter 18 and say, look, Paul went through that very kind of thing. But notice what happens. What's 18:2 say? And he Acts 18:2. What's it say? Acts 18:2. He found these people. Here it was. He's in need, and lo and behold, he found somebody. Brian, will you turn over to 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 8?
We are troubled on every side, yet not distressed. We are perplexed, but not in despair.
Okay, so another passage that reinforces the fact that Paul said, I've been over some really rough roads. But he said, I've got, as Bonnie noted, I've got this faith in God. And here that faith pays off. He says, I found this couple. Now, he doesn't explain the finding, but sometimes, do you remember the glasses illustration that I recently used? I think it came up with Don's question. I asked the question, somebody loses their glasses, they pray, and they find the glasses. All right? Could a non-Christian lose the glasses and find them? Well, obviously, he or she could. Could a Christian pray and then the glasses are found? Yes. So when Paul finds these people, we could be looking at that from two different perspectives, right? It could be that it just happened, or it could be that he found them for what reason? Because God, in his providence, put them there. Now, here's where things really get interesting. Let's read the text carefully. He finds this Jew, this man of Pontus. This guy's come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, and then Luke gives a reason for that. But notice when this couple came to Corinth. When did they come?
Recently.
Some translations might say lately. They had not been there a little while. So, once again, here is the situation. Paul has almost nothing. Goes, I'm going to say, on faith to Corinth, even though he's got some concerns. I mean, he is a human being. He's got that fear, not only because of working perhaps in that area, but also because his physical needs are not being met. And then God says, I'm working over here as well, and at the right time, I'm going to allow what? I'm going to allow you to find these people. Here is, I believe, a great example of God's providence. But here is something else that we see. And I want to run us back to the Old Testament. It's going to be a little longer reading. It's going to be from 1 Samuel chapter 13, verses 8 through 14. This is, in my mind, one of the most important lessons for Christians to get in their heads. But a lot of people struggle with it, and Saul did. 1 Samuel chapter 13, verses 8 to 14. Longer reading. Who wants it? 1 Samuel 13, 8 to 14. Brian.
And he tarried 7 days, according to the set time that Samuel had appointed. But Samuel came not to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. And Saul said, bring hither a burnt offering to me and peace offering. And he offered the burnt offering. It came to pass that as soon as he made an end of offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him, and that he might salute him. And Samuel said, what have you done? Saul said, because I saw that the people were scattered from me, and thou camest not within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered themselves together at Michmash, therefore I said, the Philistines will come down to me against Gilgal, and I haven't made supplication to the Lord. I forced myself, therefore, and offered a burnt offering. And Samuel said to him, thou hast done foolishly. Thou hast not kept the command of the Lord, which he commanded thee. For now will the Lord have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever, but now thy kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought him a man after his own heart, and the Lord hath commanded him to be captain over his people. Because thou hast not kept that which was the Lord commanded thee.
Okay, what was Saul's sin?
Presumption.
Oh yeah, presumption. He engages in this offering when he wasn't authorized to do it. What did God say?
Samuel said wait.
Yeah, Samuel said wait. God will take care of it. And Saul, and we'll just use the clock, but he's watching the clock, so to speak. You know, day one, day two, day three, nobody shows up, still perhaps praying and waiting. Day four, day five, day six, day seven. Let's say day seven, it was by 6 o'clock that sacrifice had to be offered. Gets to be 5 o'clock. Saul's looking at the clock. 5:15, looking at the clock. 5:30, God, only 30 minutes are left. 5:45. 5:55. Should Saul still have had faith at 5:55? Should have. And then it gets to 5:59. Now, a lot of people at that point would do what?
Give up.
Exactly right. They would give up. They would panic. God did not fulfill his word. 5:59 and 59 seconds. What if God shows up then? He will he not, if he's faithful? And yet that is, I think, one of the greatest challenges in being a Christian. We're watching the clock, seeing the weeks, days, months go by, and we're thinking, God, time is running out. God's message to what is, you be, it begins with F and ends with L. You be faithful. Don't be concerned about the clock. God says, I have it. And Saul is the classic example of someone panicking. And I, you know, am in this category too. I don't exempt myself. But when a person has lost their house, they come and they are in a panic mode. What am I going to do? Well, look, God has promised help, and we may be the resource for that, but continue faith all the way down to the last second. And he will do what he's promised. That is, I think, one of the hardest lessons for a Christian to learn, but that is one of the most important lessons. So don't be a clock watcher. You might watch the clock, but if you're worrying as you watch the clock, really try to get rid of that. Anything that you want to say on that point, Gary?
Well, I was looking at verse 2, with Claudius had commanded all the Jews to depart to Rome, and that's why those two were there.
Correct.
Then that just shows that God can use the evil ways of men to still fulfill his purpose.
Absolutely. And that is a great lesson. He's coordinating a lot of things at the same time. Correct. All right, that it? Let's make a couple of the points here. We've got a little time left. Aquila, he was a Jew who was originally from Pontus. That was a province in northeast Asia Minor, just south of the Black Sea. When you see that word Pontus, does that bring anything to mind?
Pontius Pilate.
Well, there could be that. Certainly that might jump into the head. Anything else? Back in Acts chapter 2, we also read about Pontius. The gospel was preached to some people who were from Pontius. Now, I think it's a big stretch. There's no evidence that I'm aware of which says that Aquila and or Priscilla was there on the day of Pentecost and heard the gospel or became Christians. But still, there were some people from that area who were present on the day of Pentecost. Luke said that this couple was brought to Corinth because of a political matter. The Bible is not filled with a lot of information about politics, but it's also not silent when it comes to information about politics. We do have information about political leaders. You have that in the Old Testament as well as the New. You do have information about political events. The Bible talks about those for various reasons. And in this case, we're reading about Emperor Claudius. He was in power from AD 41 to 54. He was apparently a very bright man, smart as far as intellect, and a great administrator for the empire, but he did have some problems. One of his problems was he let people push him around. He let people manipulate him. Nobility, he allowed nobles to do that. And also he had multiple wives, and they also were good at manipulating him. So about AD 49 or 50, roughly 20 years after the church was established, he orders all the Jews to leave Rome. That sometimes was very bad for people. It's like today, if you have a fire burning, the government says, get out of your house. How much do you take? Yeah, sometimes it's whatever you can carry or whatever you can throw in the car. In this case, when the Romans expelled people, sometimes they confiscated the property. So just as a person might lose virtually everything that they had because of a fire, if you were expelled, this was not a pleasant experience in many cases. Don't know if that happened to Aquila or Priscilla or not. Got to stop it there for now.